Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Bend a Table, a monthly food subscription service for avid home cooks focused on delicious and sustainable pantry items. Learn more at bendatable.com. That's BENTOTABLE.com. And when you use code HRN for a new subscription, you get $20 off, and we at HRN get 10 bucks. Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Anastasia Lopez is coming to you from Stamford, Connecticut. And we got Jean Nahul coming to you from, what do you call that, Murray Hill? What is that?
Yep, Murray Hill.
And Matt is in his Brooklyn booth, right? You're not back in the Rhode Island, are you, in Providence Plantation?
No, yeah, Sunset Park, baby.
Yeah. Where the hell is Sunset Park exactly? What is that?
South of Park Slope.
And why do they call it Sunset Park, since they're like to me, like, all sunset things need to be in California, where the sun sets, where when you're on the water, the sun sets.
Yeah, but we have an elevated park that is, like, legit the best place to watch the sunset.
Uh-huh.
Outside of California.
Nastasia is a connoisseur of the sun going up and down. Have you ever been on, like, I'm sure, like, the north side of Long Island is also a good place to watch the sunset, because you can pretend that there's no land to your west, right?
Well, then you have the buildings, like, outlining the sunset, which is nice when you're in Long Island City.
No, not Long Island City, the actual Long Island. When you're on the Sound looking over, you can kind of pretend that it's the ocean, right?
Yeah.
Whatever. Nastasia once sent me she was going to look at a sunset, and I said to her, hey, how is the sunset? And then before she could answer, what did I say, Nastasia?
You said, you know what, never mind, I've seen every sunset. Yep.
Yeah.
That's my friend and business partner.
Yeah. So that's occasionally when she wants to show that I have no
heart.
No heart. She'll bust out the "I've seen every sunset." So last week, by the way, we took a week off. As you know, we were out at the rallies and protests here in New York in support of Black Lives Matter and in support of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and their families. So I just want to say, obviously, all of that stuff is still going on. We're doing the radio show this week anyway. And because I guess, you know, John and Nastasia, we figured this is going to be a long, 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 long road. So we want you to know we still want you to go out and support, do what you can to support Black Lives Matter. Go out to rallies. I know there's going to be a number of rallies this weekend. We're going to go to... do you guys have anything to add?
Go to marches and protests if you can, and if you feel safe and comfortable doing it in light of the COVID. And if you're able to, you know, I don't know about speaking for you and Nastasia, but, you know, if you can donate to some funds, donate to some bailout funds, donate to the NAACP, donate to Black Lives Matter. There are a lot of really great organizations out there right now where your money will make a difference.
Right. And, I feel extremely fortunate in that because I'm antibody positive, I'm not personally worried about going out and protesting. But when you do go out and protest, please, you know, try to maintain, it's impossible out there to maintain a safe distance, but, you know, try to make sure you wear your masks and try to stay safe when you're out there. And an excellent point that was brought up, on one of the, at one of the rallies was, if you have a business, try to think about doing business with Black-owned businesses as a thing that allies can do who have businesses. Try to make a point of seeking out Black-owned businesses to do work with. What do you guys have? Anything else you want to add?
I think that's great.
If you want to support both Heritage Radio and the Philando Castile Foundation, Heritage is donating. Well, Heritage is like giving 10% of the proceeds that come into Heritage this week to Philando Castile Foundation. So,
I did not know that. And also, obviously, you know, in a related note, the Museum of Food and Drink. this is a plea for help at the beginning, but the Museum of Food and Drink, obviously, which, you know, John is still working for while he works for us at Booker and Dax. We're still working hard on getting our African/American exhibit up. More on that later, because I thought I'd do for Classics in the Field today one of Dr. Jessica Harris's, who's our lead curator, one of her best-known books and the one that introduced me to her. But that's for later in the program. So any of you guys eat anything interesting, do anything interesting this week from a food standpoint?
I'm fermenting out some kiwis to make into vinegar.
Why kiwis? They're already so high in acid. So, like, in other words, like, my question is why choose something that's already so high in acid to do your fermentation on?
I don't know. I saw them at Fairway, and for some reason I just felt like doing it. I don't know. I've been fermenting out a lot of different fruits to make into vinegars. I've got rhubarb, blueberry, cranberry, strawberry. I've got some mead vinegar. I don't know. It's fun to see what they all turn out to be. So I figured, why not try kiwi?
Now, are you doping the kiwi with sugar to get the alcohol level up so that you get a higher vinegar percentage?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. So, like, what percentage sugar are you taking it up to, roughly?
I'm really just kind of eyeing it out. I should probably start taking some measurements and getting things to be a little bit more consistent, but I'd probably say it looks like a quarter of the weight of the kiwis that I put in.
That's very techy there, John.
I know, isn't it?
I don't know, like a quarter, like something like a quarter. I don't know.
Exactly.
Yeah. We didn't get a chance because it happened too recently. You want to discuss your fish feast, your tinned fish feast?
Oh, yeah, that was really excellent. I had one of my friends, Brian, over. He works for Jose Andres, and he came over, and we had some really nice wines and then these awesome tinned fish. La Brujula is the brand. They're from Galicia, Spain. And
Wait, say that again because that was unintelligible. You got to say that slowly.
La Brujula, I think is how it's pronounced. Brujula. And I got every type of, and I've been collecting these for a couple months now, and I finally got every type of tinned seafood product that is available in the U.S. So it was razor clams, cockles, large clams, a whole bunch of different types of sardines, scallops and sauce, octopus and paprika sauce, sea urchin.
That's the crazy one right there. Tinned sea urchin roe.
It was very good.
What do you think about that? Conceptually, Nastasia, what do you think?
Doesn't sound that great.
Nastasia also, remember, not a fan of razor clams. Is the only person I know who does not like razor clams. And it's you actually don't like it. It's not that you're worried about sand. It's just you don't like it, right? But it's not the sand.
No, it's not the sand.
Is it that they're too sweet and you don't like sweet clams?
I just don't like shellfish in general. I just really don't like shellfish.
What about, like, steamed mussels with... Oh, you don't like french fries. I forgot. Oh, my God.
I can do without. It's not like... That's the thing. I can eat it all. I would rather not order it.
Do you know what you...
It's not like I'm averse. Like, scallops, though.
Whoa. All scallops?
Yeah. I eat so many of them as a kid. Like, we would boil them, and then I just eat them, and...
Well, boil them. First of all, I mean, when was the last time you gave a scallop a chance? Like a real chance?
A lot, because that's the dish that most restaurants will like send out from the chef, and you're like, oh, and then I just eat it. Yeah. So I feel like
to really be like you need to do the East Coast scallop thing. But I mean, if you've done it now, if it's been ruined for you, it's ruined for you. And there's nothing I can do about it.
No, I've had amazing scallops, like the ones that Pasternak does at S. Like,
are you gonna do his? You're gonna imitate his voice for me if you're gonna?
I need to scratch my balls while doing it. But yeah, I mean, I understand what a good scallop tastes like. I understand all about it, but I just don't like it.
I just feel bad that it got ruined for you by your childhood.
No, no, no. I ate them a lot as a, like when they were like special, you know. So
which was it? They were special, or you ate them a lot, or both?
Well, like they were the special occasion food, like Mother's Day,
and boiled. So your dad cooked them for your mother on Mother's Day, and he boiled them. Is this what I'm getting?
Yeah, something like that.
Were they at least in some sort of a soup? Was it a tomato situation?
No. What?
What? But why would you boil it? I don't know. I'm trying to understand. Like, I'm in a kitchen. I have scallops. And I'm like, what am I going to do? I'm going to throw them in boiling water. And I just see, this, like, is not what comes to my head.
Yeah, I understand. It might, you know, we were a shake and bake household.
I mean, I could see scallops in a bag, shake and bake, and then like very quickly like roasted. Like that I can see. If you're a shake and bake scallops, I could design my whole life around a shake and bake scallop. But like, well, I spent a lot of money on this for special occasion. I'm going to throw it in boiling water. I mean, I don't know. John, what do you think, man? What do you think, Matthew?
I mean, I wouldn't boil a scallop, but like if that's how Nastassia and her family enjoyed them as when she was growing up, like, sure. I don't know. I mean, have you tried a boiled scallop? Like, do you have the right to crap all over it the way you are?
I've had scallop in soups.
Okay.
Right? But if you're going to put a scallop into a soup situation, right, that's the kind of that's the kind of stuff where you make like a fumet or whatever, or, you know, you make your shellfish stock. And then you reserve all of the fish parts, and then you throw the scallops in at the end. You basically toss them in at the end and let the carryover cook them as you take them to the table. Every time I've ever done like a fish stew or a fish thing and it involves scallops, the scallops, I steam cook all of the shellfish over like with white wine, and take the steaming liquids, add those to the pot to make the base soup. Use the bones from the fish to make a fumet, combine those two things, make the stock, and then fold the actual seafood products, especially something like scallops, in at the end. That's the way for decades and decades and decades that I have done any fish stew or any fish, like liquid fish product that wasn't meant to be cooked forever. I don't really care what I'm doing. I mean, that's not how I do, what's it called? Clam chowder, because they're supposed to be little rubbery garbages there. That's the whole concept, is rubbery garbages. So you hack them up and you do it. You know what I mean? But
your way is very not shake and bake.
No, but I'm saying like, I could just see, like I could see some sort of a shake and bake situation. Having like, am I the only person here who has actually made shake and bake in the 70s? Yes, obviously I'm the only one who's done it in the 70s because yeah. I'm the only one that was alive during the 70s. But I remember actually doing it. It was a real thing that we did back in the day. That is real. That happened. That is not like just like a myth, the shake and bake. Did you actually do shake and bake at your house, Nastassia, or are you just saying that?
Oh, all the time, yeah.
So they had it in the 80s as well?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, still 90s. On supermarket shelves today. Yeah,
really? You can still go buy shake and bake.
Yes.
When you were growing up, did they have that commercial?
Shake and bake, and I help.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I help. The kid did not. Well, the kid, it was a help, I guess. It was a help. Did they have the hamburger helper commercials when you were a kid?
Mm-hmm.
Did they have the Rice-A-Roni commercials?
Oh, yes.
So we basically, even though we're like, you know, more than 10 years apart, we're basically had the same kind of commercial-based childhood.
That's why Dave and I need to enter a game show together. I really think that would pay for our next product.
The game show together?
Well, then money.
We have code words that we say with each other that no one else would get.
Right.
That,
it's like, got to be like the newlywed game, but for colleagues.
Yeah,
for like business partners. Yeah,
yeah,
we would kill. We would kill.
Yeah, we would wipe them out. We would wipe them out. It's true. But I still now can't get all of these dang commercials out of my head that I just brought up. Did they have the you know, you can't have cookies for breakfast, but you can have Cookie Crisp commercial when you were a kid?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. We weren't allowed Cookie Crisp though, because that was
of course
pushing
not.
It.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, first of all, it's garbage, and it's all sugar. So.
Yeah.
Now, Booker's here, by the way. Booker's not.
Hey, Booker, where's my cake?
He can't hear you because I got the headphones on. Nastassi wants to know when you're going to bring her cake up. Now that we've entered phase one, you can get on Metro North.
End of month. So.
I'll think of a time sometime towards the end of this month.
No, there you go. Towards the end of this month. So Booker has made Nastasia's red, white, and blue sprinkle cake.
And it's made?
The cake is made. It's in the freezer.
Okay.
It needs to be thawed and iced.
To ask Nastasia why did she move out of New York City, it's the best place in the world.
Okay, so this is not the forum for this kind of discussion, Booker, but I appreciate it. Like, Booker's the only person who's like still 100% New York all the time. He's still like, yeah, New York, hell yeah, New York.
What about in like 3 weeks when it's going to be 100 degrees with 100% humidity?
He doesn't
care. With a mask.
Okay. Yeah, the mask's already Booker, feel awesome.
Booker spends 23 and a half out of every 24-hour period in his room, which has an air conditioner. So yeah. It's like...
But he's going to start riding the subway again, I thought.
Not anymore. I started taking the subway again.
So he started taking the subway now. So now he's going... Well, we'll see. Booker has endured many a New York summer on subway platforms. So, and he, for whatever
reason...
Not
with a mask.
Yes, that's true. For whatever reason, Booker prefers, like, cloudless days. One tiny, wispy cloud at 32,000 feet.
Did you tell him what happens when it's a cloudless day for nuclear bombs?
Oh, no. Did we talk about that on the air? Have we talked about that on the air? Probably.
Yes.
There was a whole city. Well, I'm not going to get into it. Not going to get into nuclear warfare and cloud cover. Right now, we can do that.
Yeah, that'll just take us straight to the end of the show. So.
Yeah, it will. I'll just keep going on.
Chat starts to revolt after about 25 minutes of non-cooking related stuff. Also, right. They said don't cook tonight. Called Chicken Delight or something.
Chicken Delight. Did I get Chicken Delight? Chicken Delight. I'll have to Google that one later. I mean, like, I can still picture that creepy hand though from Hamburger Helper, and like
yes.
the. And like this super, like that, it was like, I don't even want to get into the gender politics of the Hamburger Helper helping her make a great meal. It's just like, it's garbage. Anyway, but nothing against the product. I don't even remember what it tastes like. It's fundamentally a hamburger macaroni casserole product. Am I right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, here's a question for you. What happened to the Sloppy Joe? Does anyone still make the Sloppy Joe?
No, but they're good.
Who is this Joe?
There's a restaurant in New York City that does. Well, it's like a fast casual kind of thing, but Schnippers got the big red logo. They sell a Sloppy Joe.
Brooks's vegan Sloppy Joe.
Oh, my God. It's so good. Yeah.
Delicious.
Now, listen. Where are you with knife and fork on Sloppy Joe? Are you a pickup, drip, 8,000 napkins, and then fork up the stuff that falls on your plate?
The latter. You gotta put the sloppy in Sloppy Joe. Are you kidding me?
So you don't pull a de Blasio. You don't fork your knife and fork your Sloppy Joe. Well, open-faced turkey sandwich, you're allowed to eat with a knife and fork because it's not a sandwich. It's a lie. Right?
Sure, that makes sense.
Yeah. So what about you, John? You pick up your Sloppy Joe and have it go everywhere?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I haven't had a Sloppy Joe in a little while. The last one I probably had was Brooks's, but yeah, I think so. And yeah, Brooks's, you just kind of pick it up and eat it. Yeah.
Have I ever told you my multi-zillion-dollar food idea?
Maybe.
So
that feels like a good one to share. You probably should have told Nastasia that one at some point.
That we're never going to do.
Maybe not
on the air,
but
we're never
going to
do anything.
Here's what it is.
So I think it was Stas. You were already working. Remember when the stoners came and they wanted to make burrito tape?
Oh yeah.
So these stoners, self-styled stoners, wanted to make an edible tape so that they could tape their burritos shut. So that when they ordered their burritos, when they were stoned out of their mind, they wouldn't drip the product everywhere. You remember this, Nastasia, right? And I said to them, well, I'm not going to make you a tape, but I did invent my thing, which is the semi-changa. Have I discussed the semi-changa?
Yes, you have.
On the air? Well, I will say it again because no one has served me one yet. So what it is it's half burrito, or maybe even two-thirds burrito, and one-third to one-half chimichanga. So you have the hard base to hold the burrito with, and then you pick it up, you eat the soft burrito, and then you finish the hard chimichanga section, much like an ice cream cone. That is all kinds of winning. I would just leave it at that.
I think the edible burrito tape is the bajillion dollar idea. Those stoners
were
right.
I'm not going to pass any judgment on you for saying that, but like, what are you going to make this edible tape out of? We were working with agar strips. I mean, why do I want edible tape on my burrito? I'll tell you what I do hate. I do hate chewing on paper. When you buy like a sandwich that's goopy or goopy burrito and you peel back the paper and it gets all goop over the paper, yeah, and you can't see the paper line anymore and you start chewing on the paper, unpleasant.
Yes.
Unpleasant. What do you think about eating the rice paper on a White Rabbit candy?
Like it.
Yeah, I do too. Do you know, White Rabbit in the 80s was slightly softer, different. They changed the recipe at some time in like the, either in the, sometime in the 90s. I think in the, all through the 80s, it was the same. But I love a White Rabbit candy. You guys like, Matt and John, you White Rabbit candy people?
Never had it. Good.
Well, you've never had a White Rabbit candy?
No, man.
What the hell?
Send me one.
I mean, they're not the same anymore, but I mean, they're easy enough to get. Remember in the, what was it, early 2000s, when those ginger candies all of a sudden became the rage?
No.
The super hot ginger candies. God, I gotta get you guys on the candy train. I love those things. That's not really Nastasia's jam, though, right? Mm. All right. Quick note on bread making before, in the wake of the Adam Leonti thing, I've been experimenting a lot with bread. I've got people Instagramming me stuff and Twittering me stuff on bread and milling. Maybe we'll just do another show. I've been working a lot with milling and different sifting technologies. So I have a lot to say. I've been plowing through a bunch of the wheat that I've bought. I've been experimenting mainly with hard red winter. I don't have any hard red spring yet, and with
that's the best
soft white.
The hard red winter. That's what we made our whole grain pasta out of.
You didn't use some durum?
Hard. I'd have to look at the exact.
Probably some sort of durum. I want to try some hard red spring, but it's just not available. And I want to try some hard white. So, I mean, I have questions to get to, but like I could talk about like what I have learned over the past month in terms of flour tastes, and like here's how this is going to work. So Nastasia, I don't want you to worry. Here's what's going to happen.
Great.
Here's what's going to happen. I am going to probably do this for 3 or 4 months. I'm going to go through all of the wheat I have, plus I'm going to buy some hard white wheat and some red spring when it's available again. I'm going to be testing a bunch of different stuff because I love the product that I'm making and I think it's different. But I also like roller milled. I also like bread made from roller milled white flour, right? So I don't dislike bread made from roller milled white flour, and I don't eat foods based on whether or not I think they're healthy. I eat them based on whether I think they're delicious. I do want to tell you, if you have not milled your own flour or had very freshly milled flour or somebody else's freshly milled flour bread, it is way different and way better and way more interesting than any other whole wheat product than I've ever had. And I'm having fun working. But it's kind of like, you know, when I roast coffee, I'll roast coffee for like a year, then I'll take a pause for a year or two, then I'll do it for a year or two. I feel the same thing's going to happen to me with milling my own flour. So you don't need to worry about me doing it all the time, because Nastasia believes that anything that I get into, even slightly, that's going to be my new thing, that I'm going to become a Civil War reenactor. What else do you think I was going to do?
Leatherman.
Well, that's going to happen. Like if my family ever leaves me, my whole
Broadway.
Life has been centered around Broadway. Yeah, well.
Wait, what about Broadway? What was Dave going to do?
Oh, my God. Dave, belt out a show.
I will not.
You guys are so... You've
heard me do it on the air a million times.
Nobody knows Dave Arnold. You haven't heard him belt out a freaking show tune.
Oh, man. We're just letting it fly today. I'm going to spend hours bleeping this show.
So Booker was saying he wanted to sell... Booker was saying he wanted to sell his brother, I don't know where this came up, but he was very anti his brother. And you know, as he, and so I started singing "Boy for Sale" from Oliver, and then Booker did not enjoy that very much. But you know, of course, I know Oliver by heart. I mean, who doesn't know Oliver by heart?
You also know Les Mis. You do "Fiddler on the Roof."
I used to literally know "Fiddler on the Roof" by heart because in sixth grade I was Tevye, and back then when I had nothing else on my mind, I memorized the entire play.
But you also
in a night.
Do the dance moves. I mean,
I mean, how hard is "Deedle Diddle Deedle Diddle Deedle Diddle Dum"? You go around the room all day long. I bitty bitty bum. Come on, man. I mean, this is something that stays with you forever. You never lose. By the way, I think he lived very close to where I live.
Also,
now.
Dave, you and I were saying we were going to start a band last week, and I was like, I can't sing. And you were like, that's okay.
Don't worry about it. It's not important. Not important.
Yeah. Why were we going to do that?
I don't know. Just something other than what we were doing, which doesn't appear to be working. by the way,
we got any cooking questions?
By the way, hey, we've been talking about bread baking, man.
Yeah.
Hamburger helper.
I don't want to go back to bread baking.
He just asked you to. I just heard him do it. Oh, but I have to say though, not about bread in particular, but I am loving this pseudo Detroit pizza I've been working on. Loving it. Loving the pseudo Detroit pizza. I wouldn't mind going back to Detroit, not just for the pizza though. I do miss their hot dogs. They have such good, or as they call them, conies. Inexplicably, they call them conies. They're very good. But you didn't care about it, right? You just got the chili. You didn't even get the dog. Did you even try one of those dogs?
Yeah, you broke me off a piece.
Hmm. Speaking of, are you eating one right now? Old stamps. How do stamps make the noise of thumbtacks?
They're in like a thing. No.
See, you're doing to us what you hate for people to do to you. This is why you don't go to movie theaters, because you don't like the popcorn bag.
That's true. I didn't know if you could hear it.
Okay. From Thomas Zernikin via email, I recently tried to make orgeat. I started by blending my hot water and almonds. Then I poured this mix directly into the rotor, presumably the rotor of a Spinzall, our centrifuge, and spun it for 20 minutes or so. There was no clarification or separation. Yeah, that's not the way the orgeats work for the rotor, for the Spinzall. In general, I'm usually making such a large quantity of those things that I go through a nut bag, and then a press is actually how I do those things in real life. But when I do nut milks in the Spinzall, I do it around the quantity of nuts. So I always have the quantity of nuts in the recipe be roughly 400.
What kind of nuts?
These nuts. Is that what you're looking for?
Yes.
Yeah. But if you now I have that whole song going through my head. So if you do that, the idea is that all of the liquid that you blend in will get filtered through the nuts, through these nuts, as they go through, as they're in the rotor, and you'll get, because the first couple hundred milliliters you get off are going to look almost clear in a continuous situation. But you're not going to get a decent separation out of those hard pureed nuts like that. Even in a big centrifuge, you know, you will get it when you're running it at 4,000 Gs for like 20 minutes. But with this one, it's really more about trying to fill the rotor with these nuts solids and then getting the stuff out. But in general, like nut bags, nut milk bags, and they are, I think, the way to go. But there endeth the suggestive nut bag talk. Aaron Holback from Instagram. Okay, now Nastasia's going to hate this one. You're going to hate this one, Nastasia. Well, just because it's like highly technical and like all tweaked out. You hate it. Anyway. Hey, Dave, I'm building a proofing box, so we're back on bread. You happy about that, Nastasia? For those of you that don't know, sometimes if people can't control the environment in their kitchen, the humidity or the temperature, they build a proofing box. Proofing box is usually a higher temperature than you would have in your normal house or kitchen, but it's consistent, so you can kind of guarantee the proofing rates, and you need a relatively high humidity and a relatively high temperature, but also a relatively large volume because you're going to be putting a bunch of bread into it. I am building a proofing box by retrofitting a Coleman cooler with an immersion circulator and closet shelving. I intend on mapping the boule, i.e. the bread boule, the bread boule's height through its proofing by using a laser ping rangefinder with 1 millimeter resolution. How do you like that, Stas?
Okay.
Yeah. I was wondering if the appropriate time to bake is when the boule's maximum height has plateaued. I'm just getting into the modernist bread and have yet to find a conclusive answer to this question. I would say no. That's probably too late. Thank you, Aaron Holbeck. And then as a follow-up, I found that measuring the height proportional to volume is an unreliable gauge of fermentation. In fact, at either maximum, the dough would be over-fermented. I use the finger dent technique and am now exploring ways to quantify this qualitative test. For those of you that don't know, the finger dent technique when you're proofing bread is if you push on the bread as it's proofing, so you've done the shape. And by the way, by far and away, the thing that when you're beginning in bread that you're going to probably F up is the shaping part of it. So much of the structure of the final bread is, because think about this, you do what's called bulk fermentation, it ferments, and then often you punch it down or you do whatever you're going to do after bulk fermentation. Then you divide it into whatever its final loaves and or buns are, and then you do the shaping. And so much of the texture and structure of the bread are done in that shaping thing, and I think that's where a lot of people mess up. Anyway, So the finger dent technique, after you've done your final shaping and you're proofing it, that's my large dog being happy that Jen just got home from work. So when you push in, if you push and
you
push on it a little bit, and if it pops right back at you, like if it's very elastic, it means it hasn't inflated enough to reach anywhere near the edge of the gluten's kind of extent. If you push it in and your finger goes into it and it starts collapsing, well, you waited too long, because at that point, any kind of hit's going to make it deflate. What you want is for it to still be going up when you put it into the oven. The oven hits it, the temperature goes up, boom, you get your oven spring, but it doesn't collapse, and then boom, you get your perfect bread. So that's the dent test. Anyway, so here's Nastasi's going to hate this even more. I intend to use a series of linear servos to emulate a finger impression while mapping the rebound volume through a 3D depth sensor. If I'm able to automate calling the proof, it may be interesting to design a consumer model with more economical components. My inspiration for this project is no kitchen gadget can simplify calling proof for you, which is a quote from Modernist Bread 3-220. With that said, I fear that I'm innovating for innovation's sake. How would you proceed? FYI, my summer research plans were foiled by the pandemic, so I've turned to experiment at home. Thank you, Aaron Hoback. So I would definitely say that this is something that you should do, Aaron, for your own edification. I don't know anyone's going to buy a proof tester. What do you guys think?
With the sudden popularity of bread baking at home, I think this is a stretch.
There's also, I'm going to put it to you this way, Aaron. I think this is kind of fascinating. I'd love to know, there's a huge long history in industrial cooking of testing things that are kind of untestable and coming up with standards. And then those standards become kind of the standard. So in the pea industry, there's a thing called the tenderometer, and they have a very specific shaped instrument that crushes a very specific amount of peas and measures the very specific weight that it takes to crush that, and that's turned into a tenderometer reading for peas. And a lot of things have these very strange kind of standards that are built up. So who knows? Maybe you'll come up with the proof standard. But I will also say I watched recently a video where someone did the same recipe at four different proofs under just right, or under, a little bit under, just right, and like a lot over, to show the difference between them. And the difference in whether they proofed it correctly or incorrectly is not as dramatic as you might think. But it's instructive to go look at their videos to see what the effect of proof is on bread. Okay. Brian Yurko writes in, hey, hope you're well. I had a question about vacuum pumps. Any suggestions on what? Nastasia's like, geez, vacuum pumps.
Yeah, my guy.
Any suggestions on what to do to get a seized pump going again? And just because I know Dave likes the details, it's a Bush R5RB0021C with an electric motor all inside of an UltraSource UltraVac 250. Brian, so most likely luckily for you, The bush pumps are, well, unluckily for you, bush pumps are fantastically expensive. Luckily for you, they're also completely rebuildable. The odds that there's something wrong with the electric motor are probably zero. Those motors are a beast. Almost certainly what has happened, and by the way, you can go online and if you look up the R-Series bush pumps, there's a complete rebuild guide online that's available for them. Let me see if I can get you the title for it. The rebuild guide is titled Maintenance and Repair Manual, R5 Series. And the thing's all there, and it's complete down to like how to get the taper pins out without damaging them. It's a very good document. Undoubtedly, what has happened is this. Inside of an oil-based vacuum pump, there is a spinning wheel, like an eccentric spinning wheel. On that spinning wheel is a vane that it pops up, and it's spring-based. And that vane, I think they're carbon, I'm not sure. That vane, I forget exactly what they're made out of. That vane pushes up against the outside of the pump and sweeps through the oil and acts like a Hi-Li scoop. Going back to the 70s, acts like a Hi-Li scoop and scoops the air out from the low pressure area through the oil and out the high pressure area. And if you shatter one of those vanes, it'll seize the pump right up. Most likely you have a thrown or shattered or stuck vane. So you need to drain the pump, you know, get rid of the oil, that oil is ruined, clean all that stuff out, and either repair or fix the vanes, which is a very small price to pay compared to the price of that Bush vacuum pump. Was that a blessedly short enough answer for you, Anastasia?
Yes.
All right. Rachel Meyer wrote in, and I don't have an answer for this one, but more of a throwing it out there. Maybe we have in the listening audience a pectin expert, maybe one of the people from CP Kelco, because I don't know that I still have our contacts at CP Kelco. Piper Christensen, who used to work with us, his family is part of CP Kelco, but he doesn't talk to us anymore. Now we still talk to him. He doesn't talk to us anymore, right? Right, Saz?
Yep.
But anyway, he's got the Kelco contact. This episode is brought to you by Bend to Table, a monthly food subscription service for avid home cooks focused on delicious and sustainable pantry items. So I got my France box, and one of the things in it was the lavender blackberry rhubarb jam from V. Smiley. So what I recommend you do with this, spread it on toast. And for toast, if you got the Bend to Table essentials box, in that box, you may find a Maine Grains Red Fife wheat flour, and you can make a delicious, very full-flavored whole wheat bread from the Maine Grains Red Fife. I will say this, if you're not used to baking with whole grains, realize that you're gonna need to have a much higher hydration ratio. It's gonna take more water than normal. I would let it ferment for a relatively long time so that everything gets absorbed, and it's gonna feel a little bit different in your hand. If you want great flavor, but want a more traditional kind of fluffy loaf and you're not used to baking with whole grains, it's okay to mix that with 50-50, that flour and either a bread flour or even an AP flour. And then you can do what's closer to a Jim Leahy, no-knead, a bread kind of a recipe. And then when we had stuff left over, we toasted it. And guess what we spread on it? The V Smiley lavender blackberry rhubarb jam from the Bend to Table box. So that's what I would do. Go to bendtotable.com to start your monthly subscription. Use the discount code HRN to get $20 off a new subscription, and Bend to Table will donate $10 to support Cooking Issues and all of HRN, which stands for Heritage Radio Network's programming. It's Rachel Meyer from Shoots and Roots. And by the way, Shoots and Roots is a bitters business that was formed by three PhD botanist women. I think the only one of them I really know is Rachel, but it's kind of a cool concept company. They make interesting bitters with very kind of non-standard botanical flavors like pine forest and whatnot. It's Rachel Meyer from Shoots and Roots. I accidentally made a Jello shot by mixing 350 milliliters of Everclear with a whole barbecued orange through muddling. And the Jello that it produced is delicious. Would you be willing to work with me on making this a thing? The chemistry, average pectin per orange and presentation, et cetera, too good to pass up on this grilling season. So what has happened, pectin, which is the setting thing that's in oranges, is not soluble in highly alcoholic mediums. So you've gotten this pectin, you've muddled it, and then because of the alcohol, for some reason you've got the set just right, such that it sets up in the glass. I don't know how to reproduce that because pectin is, as they say in French, fiddly. So, like, it's real fiddly. So, like, I would say I'm going to pass this off. Hopefully someone else in the listening crew has a way to kind of make this more predictable. You know, some way to measure it or some way to bulletproof the recipe such that it always works. But, you know, pectin destabilization in alcohol is something that, you know, obviously I've known about for many years and have used in, for instance, in the book Liquid Intelligence, I use for doing autohustinos, but I've never tried to actually create a gel with it on a time after time basis. But hopefully someone in the audience knows something about it. All right.
We had somebody send in a voice memo. Do you want to try sure. and answer this question? Yeah. When I play this, there's a chance that you're going to hear it at some sort of weird speed. Just let's see if we can roll with it.
What's up, Dave, Nastasia, Matt, and any other road crew? This is Paul from Seattle, longtime listener. I've noticed the rage barometer has gone down on the show lately, so I'm calling in with some questions about things you hate, mainly cold brew coffee. I recently bought a Spinzol. Right now, cold brew is my only substitute for not having AC, as the apartment that I'm quarantined in is slowly warming up this summer. And I'm also looking to make some low-quality individuals versions of some of the coffee drinks from Liquid Intelligence. I know that you and Paul Adams have argued a lot about cold brew. I remember from a back episode you said your current cold brew process is slightly different from what's in the Spinzol recipe book. I was just wondering what your current cold brew process is right now. Also, in case you and Nastasia are running out of things to fight about, bonus question. How do you partially clarify the preserved lemon juice for the Corsair? Do you undercut the enzyme amounts, or do you run it for less time, or what? Thanks, everyone. Be safe.
Well, Paul, you increased my rage meter just by having that. Like, Nastasia couldn't even let me listen to the question that you were saying.
I couldn't even hear it. I didn't even hear it. I thought it was just completely silent.
Oh.
Yeah.
Weird.
Oh, that makes more sense.
Yeah.
So Nastasi's like talking to me in the middle of the question.
Yeah, I thought.
And I'm like, Nastasi, what the hell? I'm trying to listen to the guy talk.
Yeah, that's weird.
That's so weird that you could. Okay, whatever.
Did you hear it, John?
Okay.
So I thought and did you hear
you don't get to hear that one, Nastasia.
You wouldn't have liked it anyway. But I was like, what the hell is she doing? The guy's like, hey, you don't have enough rage anymore. And, like, literally in the middle of him saying, I don't have enough rage anymore, Nastasia is sitting there, like, just, like, talking over him like he's not talking.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm like, what the hell?
His plan works perfectly. He didn't know exactly what would happen, but he did establish rage.
Even for Nastasia, that was hardcore. I mean, You didn't know you did it, which makes it a little bit different. But I was like, whoa, dude. Whoa. So on cold brew, look, here's the what I do now. I forget what I did in the recipe manual, but really with the cold brew, it's all about forcing the liquid through the product under pressure, right? So like if I was going to build my own cold brew machine, what I would do is take a high pressure tube and put the water in at the top and force it at a high pressure, almost like espresso style, through the puck and then over and over and over again. And that's kind of what you're doing when you're doing cold brew in the Spinzol, is you're putting the cold brew in, it's going in the tubes, it's getting fed into the Spinzol rotor, getting forced down to the bottom, being held there under pressure, and then getting forced up by the weight of the new liquid coming in, and it's cycling out cold brew. And so, you know, if I was ever going to build a cold brew machine, it would be built on kind of a pressure situation. But yeah, I don't like cold brew. I just don't like it. It's not that I don't want you to like it. It's just I don't like it. Do you like it, John? Mm-hmm. What was the other part of the question? What was the other part of the question, Matt? I forget what the other part of the question was.
Limoncello clarification.
Oh, not limoncello, yeah. Preserve lemons. So the trick with the preserved lemons, run your stuff continuously and don't use... First of all, there's so much... We're blending the liquid and the pith and everything. So just if you use just the normal amount of SPL, it's not enough to fully clarify it because there's just so much pectin and garbage in it that it's not going to clarify anyway. So just don't let it fully clarify. So you're going to run it continuous, and you're going to do it. Don't use wine finding agents. Just use SPL and let it stay cloudy, because you don't have a lot of in the Corsair, which is preserved lemon, Moroccan preserved lemon, simple syrup, lime juice, tequila, and hot stuff of your choice. You don't have that much lime juice in there, and so you really want there to still be some body in that lemon juice to give it a nice kind of shaking texture. Good enough answer? No, did I answer that? All right. Speaking of lemons, I'll get back to Matthias's question. Nastasia, your mom wrote in answers for the lemon person. You want to tell them?
I don't have it.
So I have to read your answers from your mom.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to.
Your mom gave you answers, and said that you can attribute them to your dad, and then sent them to you, and then you emailed them to me, and yet I have to read them.
I don't have them in front of me. I'd have to dig it. And it was a text, so I'd have to look. I just read it.
All right. Don't water the tree. Don't water the tree, only the bottom of the trunk. Remove all the leaves from the bottom of the trunk so it will be like a topiary. Fruit is on top, like a basket filled with fruit. Shake the tree to get rid of bugs. Really? Shake a tree to get rid of? How big is this tree? Pick lemons.
My mom is very strong. It's not the tree.
I believe that. Yeah. So you're like, it's not the tree. She's like an almond harvesting machine. You ever seen those almond harvesting machines? They're like, it's like a skid steer, and you drive it up to the tree, and this arm comes out, and it's like, I told you to drop the almonds! And the almonds hit the ground. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's how I'm going to picture your
the
mom.
The almonds hit the ground. Yeah.
The almonds hit the ground. And I think some of the almond shakers also have like giant nets that they can put out. Anyway, shake the tree to get rid of bugs, but only if you're... Only if you're Lopez
first
strength.
Generation Russian.
Yeah. If you're Nastasia's mom's strength, you can shake the tree to get rid of bugs.
She's like, I chewed ice when I birthed you, and I was like, all right.
Yeah. First of all, she's not even. It's not like she's shaking them out. She's just shaking the tree so hard that the bugs are like, to hell with this.
Yeah.
Four. Pick the lemons in the cool of the morning. I feel like this is like a advice that could be used. It sounds like a 60s song, does it not? Pick the lemons in the cool of the morning.
Yeah. We also think that she's trolling us on Instagram.
Yeah, she is. Nastasia's mom, right, has like a garden, and she lives in, they're still in Covina?
Yeah.
So they're in Covina, which, you know, has like sunlight and whatnot, like, and they have a garden, they're growing stuff. So she's like, everyone should get out and garden. You're like, hey, thanks, Nastasia's mom. So what am I going to...
My bedroom faces a brick wall in New York.
Yeah. Like my windowsill gets like, you know, half hour of sunlight a day, and it's not even direct. You know what I mean? I'm on the fourth floor of a 20-story building. Anyway, you know, the shade I get is from like, you know, the trucks outside. You know, okay. Pick the lemons in the cool of the morning, using clippers to cut a small amount of stem with the lemon. Now you're too lazy to do that stuff. You're a ripper. Twist. Well, at least you're nice. Twist and pull.
To try the lemon. I got it. So
how is it? You're gonna send me some? I don't want to know.
For you. I'm waiting for you to try it.
All right, and remove any yellow or discolored leaves daily. Speaking of picking, let me get to this real quick. Who wrote it in? Someone wrote it in. Something about Andy Shipman wrote in. Hey Dave, what would you do with 20 pounds of sour cherries? For the first year I harvested, I made jam. The second year I made wine. It had a low ABV and too acidic to drink straight up. Yeah, that makes sense. I used it as a mixer for a year. Last year I soaked them in brandy for a couple of months and had great cherry brandy for late summer cocktails. Going to pick next weekend. Have any thoughts? I don't have a Spinzol. Well, first thing you should do, Shipman, is go buy yourself a Spinzol. I mean, they're cheap now. I mean, come on, please. Second is we should go pick cherries. I'm going to go up with my sister and my brother-in-law, who are both positive, when they have the cherries at Fishkill Farms, because this would be the first year ever that I can pick cherries and not die. You want to do it?
You told me I couldn't.
Well, you can. You just have to stay 6 feet away from me.
Why? I don't care if I get it.
All right. And you're not going to visit anyone who's at risk? All right, fine, whatever, man. Whatever. But anyway, we should totally do it. Here's some things you should do. You should go look at Pie Marches On and follow any of Monroe's recipes on cherry pie. How did you not make cherry pie in all of these things you've talked about cherries and not make cherry pie? That's crazy. John, is that crazy? Yeah, crazy. Also, when you're making brandied cherries, may I suggest that this makes an excellent gift for people. Here's something I've always wanted to test and I've never done. Get yourself some pectin methyl esterase, which is the pectin strengthening enzyme. Add a little bit of calcium chloride and a little bit of pectin methyl esterase. Do a pre-soak in that to try to strengthen the pectin in the cherry so that they don't get soft, right? Now, I'm not, which is, I believe, how they actually also do it for the fakey maraschino cherry ones. You don't want that much, but it would be nice to keep them firmer than they are when they're brandied normally. And then you want to get the sugar level up slowly over time in your cherry so that they don't shrink. Look up any one of the great guides on this because you don't want them to shrink. And then this makes the perfect gift for anyone who likes cocktails. If you make – so Toby Cicchini, one of the contenders and Absolute gives him this as the creator of the Cosmo, and, you know, from Long Island Bar, writer for the New York Times, et cetera, et cetera. Toby has a sour cherry tree, and he takes and makes them all into brandy cherries, which he then gives out as gifts. And what's going to happen is that over time, every year, people will be like, oh, I can't wait. Shipman's going to give me his brandied cherries again this year. I can't wait. And then one year, someone's going to tick you off. You're going to have a sign of the cross against somebody, right, Stas? And then that person's not going to get the cherries. And you're not going to have to say to them, you're not going to have to say, yo, Billy, I'm pissed at you, right? That's not how it's going to work, because there's going to be like, yo, Andy didn't give me my cherries this year. What did I do? And so you're going to be able to use these cherries as a lever against your friends, enemies, and acquaintances for the rest of your life. What do you think, Nastasia?
I love that. You know what I think about enemies and signs of crosses.
Yeah, so I have a new one. I'm reading this book. So we've explained Sign of the Cross. Nastasia is a big fan of Sign of the Cross.
It always works.
Oh, yeah, we could talk about it again later. We don't have time to fully get into the sign of the cross. And we don't even have time to get into sealing your enemies in cubes and throwing them into the deepest holes of the earth.
We should definitely devote the appropriate amount of time to the classic.
It's already 12:56.
Yeah, hold up. Wait,
one second. Jessica Harris.
Yeah, hold on, wait. I can actually finish this. I've only got two quick questions. Let me just get them. Okay. From Matthias Sexton via Instagram, or Matthias. I've been reading through modernist cuisine books over the lockdown period, and after reading the section on reductions, I found the last paragraph about reverse osmosis. I did a little further reading on this and found that the fruit juice industry has been leveraging forward osmosis to concentrate fruit juices. Also think maple syrup has been doing it. I found some of the filters are relatively affordable. I was wondering if you had any information regarding this, as I've been thinking of recreating this for myself. I don't, but someone on the chat room has some good videos to point to, and this is something that DIY people do. Initial concentration, not the full concentration, because it's hard to get very, very high concentrations using RO just because the pressures aren't high enough. But there's a lot of stuff out there. Look at what the maple syrup people are doing. There's DIY people out there, and you can follow the videos, and hopefully someone in the chat room will send me some more information on it. Josh writes in on liquid nitrogen. I'm trying to get started working with liquid nitrogen, specifically nitro modeling. I've been watching some old YouTube videos with Dave at Booker and Dax. He has a small handheld container that he uses to transfer the liquid nitrogen from the large tank to the shaker or glass. What is it, and where can I buy one? Almost looks like a small handheld thermos. Well, Josh, you know what it is?
Small handheld thermos, but tell him what he can't do with it.
Ding, ding, ding. You cannot close it. That's how that German dude blew himself up, almost killed himself, almost wiped out his girlfriend too. So anytime you're going to have a liquid nitrogen thermos, two things. Don't get one with glass in it. Get one that's all stainless steel. We use Stanley's at the bar, and the black ones that we used to use at the bar were Stanley's. Stainless steel Stanley's with, you know, black painted outsides. The Misfits sticker that Tadaguchi put onto ours is optional but encouraged. And then they last almost forever.
But don't seal it.
Well, as soon as you get it, take the lid and throw the lid away. This way, no one can seal it because you've thrown the lid away. So whenever we get one into the bar, we take the top lid and throw it away and the bottom lid and throw it away. And that's it. And if you need to cap it, you can get like a styro plug and like like let it rest over the top, but don't plug them. And remember, you don't want to let them go all the way dry before you refill them, because once they warm up, you have to spend all of that energy in the form of boiling liquid nitrogen to re-chill it down to liquid nitrogen temperature. So try to keep it nice and full. And you know, if it should break, you'll notice the outside frosts over. That's how you tell if a dewar is broken or if your thermos is broken. All right. So, and we're actually going to almost make it because we started a little bit late because of technical issues. So here we go. You ready for us actually to do this? To be done?
Yes.
All right. Classics in the field, yeah. All right. We got Jessica Harris. Dr. Jessica Harris has been a longtime friend of, I've known her for a long time personally, but of the museum, and is currently the head curator, the lead curator of the show that was supposed to open in March, and we all know how opening things in March happened, of African/American, Making America's Table, which is Making the Nation's Table, which is an exploration. John, of course, you know, one of the creators of the museum staff, people working on it, so it has my back on the corrections of things like that, is an exploration of the contributions, the kind of widespread, systemic, and largely unknown contributions of African Americans to American foodways, in general, so things that you might not know. You want to give a couple, John?
Yeah, Alfred Crowell in 1896 or 1897 was the second African American in Pittsburgh to receive a patent, and he patented like the clicker lever mechanism on the side of ice cream scoops, which is kind of my favorite thing to point out. I know, Dave, your favorite example is Frederick McKinley Jones.
That's
who
true.
Is largely responsible for a lot of the cold chain and shipping foods.
The guy invented the reefer truck, and his company, right? The company that he founded, he co-founded. He was the inventor, and then there was a money guy, and they co-founded this company. And they still make all of the reefer trucks and the reefer boxcars. So if you've ever had a piece of food that was brought to you, it was most likely brought to you by a truck. Even if it got on a rail or got on a boat, it was most likely went from the final place to the market in a truck. That truck was refrigerated, and that refrigerator is a direct result of his work. So like, the entire food system as we know it would not make sense without him. Anyway, built the very first kind of portable refrigerator compressor. We tried to get one, and the company wouldn't give it to us. I was so pissed. They had one that they had kind of had decommissioned. It looked like we were going to get it for the exhibit, and then for some reason they just crapped out. Did they ever give us a reason why they crapped out on that?
No, they just kept kind of saying it was too big to move, and yeah. They instead recommended we get little toy truck replicas.
No, yeah, joy. Yeah, I really want to go to a museum so I can see a toy truck replica. Right?
I'm into that.
The toy truck? Even Nastasia wanted to start the Matchbox Cars Museum. When you were a kid, did you collect Matchbox Cars? Or were you more of a Hot Wheels?
Both.
Both? I felt like when I was growing up, you had to choose Hot Wheels or Anyway, whatever. I'm not going to get into it. So Jessica Harris is the lead curator. I've known her for a long, long time. And even before I knew her, I knew her work. So she is, I would say, the kind of foremost scholar on cooking of the African diaspora in the United States and also Africa itself. And I remember the first trip I ever took with her was to Senegal with also a friend of the show, Pierre Cham. And I'll tell you, if you ever get a chance to travel through Senegal with Dr. Harris, it is a real treat. But well before I knew her, when I was first researching foods from Africa, there was very, 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 very little written about it. And most of the stuff that was written about it was written from a very kind of white and European perspective. And so she had been writing books. I guess she started writing books in the late 80s, early 90s, but I think one of her most influential kind of middle books was 1998, The Africa Cookbook, Tastes of a Continent. And it's one of the first books I was able to find that really dealt with the subject of African food from I think, a good perspective. So you should go check that out. You should check her out, and you should check out the exhibit that she curated as soon as we are able to open that thing again. We don't
also
have a date.
Also, her book. Wait, I want to say one thing. Her book, My Soul Looks Back, I enjoyed because it wasn't about food. It was about, like, growing up, I mean, living in New York in the 60s and how she was friends with James Baldwin and Maya Angelou, and it's really cool. And she gives a playlist to listen to while you're reading it.
Yeah, there's a section in that book where she talks about how mean Nina Simone was to her, which is kind of funny, right?
Yes.
Nina Simone was so mean to her.
Yes.
So yeah. Mean.
Yes.
But anyway, Dr. Harris is a treasure. I'll give you one more story about, so like Dookie Chase, a very famous New Orleans restaurant, Nastasia had organized for them to come do the MOFADS Gala. If you don't know who they are, like, get out from under your rock and look up who they are. But they, for years, forever, they've never done anything outside of their restaurant. They've never needed to. They've been very kind of New Orleans focused, and even within New Orleans, within kind of their restaurant and the community that went to their restaurant. And, you know, the last time I went to New Orleans, you know, Dr. Harris called, told me I had to go talk to them about cocktails. I'm like, I don't really know why they want to hear from me, but I'll do it because you told me to. And then when I got there, I found out she had called them and told them that they needed to talk to me. And it's just the kind of thing. It's like, well, why'd you do it? She's like, well, Dr. Harris said to. And that was all you needed to say, because people just don't say no to her. You know what I mean? But it was, you know, she wanted them to come to do something at the gala. And they were actually going to come up to New York and, I hope, make shrimp Clemenceau, which is my favorite thing that I had when I was there.
They still, when we get back to whatever, I think they still will.
Yeah, but just to show how much weight, she's the kind of person that could just tell someone of that stature, please do it, and they will do it. So she is someone who she is someone whose word can be trusted. And that's it. Cooking Issues.
Cooking Issues is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.